WRRI, Public Radio International.
Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston C.A.
When I was about 12 years old, I discovered from a newspaper report that three or four incredibly ancient veterans of the Civil War were still living. It seemed impossible to me that anyone could survive, actually still walk, or at least sit, on this planet, who had fought in a conflict that ended some 90 years ago and was now as mythical as the Persian Wars. When I wondered aloud how long it might be until the last veteran died, my father, a sociologist, informed me that each of them had a statistical life expectancy of less than 6 months. For a child possessed by the historical imagination, there was only one thing to do. Before it was too late, I must write each of them and ask him to tell me, as one generation to another, what he had done in the war and whether he had met any of the famous people I was reading about in books. The fact that each of these men was nearly 100 years older than I made the task more urgent than anyone could imagine, and off I wrote to the three addresses that the newspaper had thoughtfully provided. Some precocious impulse led me to enclose self-addressed stamped envelopes. Over the course of the next few weeks,
of all the landscapes we inhabit in our lives, none is more mystical, profound, or difficult than that of the past, whether it's the terrain of public history or personal memory. Most often it's both, a contoured topography of events great and small, and personalities distant and near, who shape our sense of who we are in the brief passage of our own lives. Like all exotic landscapes, its exploration calls upon qualities of candor and courage. But if the challenge is met, we can profit from the poet's wisdom that we shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. My guest is Christopher Clausen, professor of English literature at Pennsylvania State University and author of My Life with President Kennedy. Chris, welcome back to Dialogue.
Thank you.
This is a book of essays, remarkable essays about memory and history. And in the title essay, Chris Clausen, you met President Kennedy the same way many of us did, that is to say, not personally, but nonetheless indelibly, by coming of age when he came to power, and then he passed into legend. And I guess that's the first question, Chris Clausen. Was there something about JFK and the 60s that intertwined the public and the personal in a way that might not have been, in a very emphatic way, that might not have been true?
Exactly. I think that the slogan, the personal is the political, which bedevils us in many ways, because in so many respects the personal is not political and the political is not personal, really goes back to the 60s. And so much of the 60s is the legacy of a man who was president for only a little over 2 years. This is particularly so if you were a college freshman, as I was, when President Kennedy was elected, so that you felt a kind of kinship with him. You felt that you knew him, that you had gotten to know him at a special time in both your lives.
Mm-hmm. Chris Clausen, is this a particularly important way of knowing history? That is to say, to take an emblematic figure like John Kennedy and try to define where that public world that he lived in intersects the private world the rest of us lived in?
Yes. One of the things that fascinate me is the intersection of public and private worlds. The public and private are separate realms in a sense, and yet they're constantly interpenetrating, just as the present and the past interpenetrate. I think if one grew up in the 1960s, one may be especially conscious of this, that one's own emotions were invested in a public world in a way that is not always the case, so that one's private life became tied up with a political figure, with a political movement, with political occurrences. Mm-hmm. And the public life, conversely, became more and more identified with the personal qualities of public figures, so that in the last 40 years, we have had a dramatic change, for example, in presidential campaigns, something we're conscious of having just completed one, in that presidential candidates display their families to a much greater extent than they used to. They almost always go by nicknames now. Franklin Roosevelt was never publicly known as Frank. Even as recently as Ronald Reagan, he was never publicly known as Ron.
Yeah.
But we've just completed a campaign in which Al and Joe ran against, well, George is already one syllable, so it doesn't need to be reduced, but George and Dick.
Yeah.
All of the names that are more than one syllable are reduced to nicknames.
Well, actually, in point of fact, there are at least two essays in this collection that treat precisely this question, the fact that, and this may be one of the less admirable results of the Kennedy presidency, but the fact that personality now does dominate politics, political life. You know, we have to reveal yourself as, quote, a nice guy or a nice gal to get
Not only nice, but you have to feel other people's pain. You have to have qualities of empathy. You have to be the sort of person who can communicate on television an interest in ordinary people's everyday concerns, which was not always true, or not, let's say, not equally true. No doubt Franklin Roosevelt did in fact communicate that in speeches, in newsreels, on the radio. But he was also elected for far more impersonal reasons, for reasons having to do with policy. And while there are certainly still voters who are interested in policy, the emphasis has shifted now to the personality of the candidate for any public office.
I think at one point you referred to it as the age of Oprah.
Yes.
Now there's something to that effect.
The Oprah Winfrey approach to I think I was quoting someone else, the Oprah Winfrey approach to public life.
And at another point, you make, I think, a corresponding point that this affects journalism in a way, in that tabloids now, with their coverage of the intensely personal and the intensely dramatic and, of course, hyperbolic, influence mainstream media in a way that might have been unanticipated.
This has particularly happened in the last 10 years since the Jennifer Flowers episode when Bill Clinton was running for president in 1992. The Jennifer Flowers story was originally taken up by a tabloid called Star, and the quality news media sort of gazed in horrified fascination, saying first, we would never do that. And then a couple of weeks later, we want some of that.
We won't do anything else but that.
So Jennifer Flowers led to, well, the Clinton administration was the personal life of President Clinton lent itself to that sort of coverage from the beginning to the end of his administration. But the change in journalistic ethics, or at least journalistic practice, is much more interesting because, of course, there have been public figures with scandalous private lives before, but the New York Times never covered them quite so enthusiastically.
Right. Nor did I feel as a reader that I had to know it.
Yes, yes.
Let me take a moment from our conversation, Christopher Clausen, just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is Christopher Clausen, professor of English literature at Pennsylvania State University and author of My Life with President Kennedy, published by the University of Iowa Press. Chris, the topic we're on, of course, is memory and the use of memory, and that, of course, is a question of encountering the past. And you have an essay in here, a very profound one, which for me, and I think for those listening, usefully raises the question of what are the qualities of the past? I mean, why? What is it about? What does it contain? What is it like? And how accessible can it be? I mean, at one point, the expression a foreign country is used, which it very much is or can be. And in that essay, as kind of leitmotifs or icons or examples, you use both an 1863 family photograph from Germany, and a Greek helmet from 490 BC.
Yes. When I was a child, the past as such fascinated me. It wasn't merely particular incidents in the past. It was the whole concept of pastness in a way that it's very hard to explain how a small child could have had this, what seems like a highly philosophical conception of the past. But the sense of it as being something that's complete, that can't be changed. The sense of history as a kind of Platonic realm of completed incidents, almost like a ballet, almost like the memory of a ballet, let us say, just fascinated me. And one of the images that provoked this set of emotions, they're really emotions more than thoughts in a child of that age, was a helmet in a museum that had been unearthed at the site of the Battle of Marathon. It had a hole in the side. Evidently, the man who was wearing it had been killed while wearing this helmet at the Battle of Marathon in the year 490 BC, when the Greeks were repelling the first Persian invasion. And that just seemed to me enthralling. I just could not get that image out of my head.
Well, actually, you plant it in the reader's head as well. And I've had similar moments. And for example, with that helmet, with the gaping opening that showed that certainly indicated that that person had been killed from a head wound there. The questions that you found interesting was, did that man know where they were going that day,
yes,
or what kind of battle would happen, or that history would remember it the way he did? I mean, was he hot and uncomfortable? Was he, what was going on?
Yes, exactly. And who was he, of course? Mm-hmm. Because you have this irony of the fact that the helmet is there for thousands and thousands of people to see now. I mean, that helmet is still alive, but nobody knows anything about the man who wore it.
Right.
He's anonymous. Mm-hmm. His body is, even his skeleton presumably, is long since reduced to dust.
Mm. But that's the completeness of that story.
The completeness of the story and the survival of the object.
Right.
The fact that the object is substantially unchanged from the time that hole was made in it, mm-hmm, while the man who was wearing it, for whom it existed, is completely as if he had never been.
And this is the richness of the past.
This is the richness of the past.
And the power of what it can be.
It's a tremendous imaginative power if your imagination works that way.
Well, that's a good, wonderful way to describe it. I'm glad also you mentioned the fact you came upon that helmet as a child.
Yes.
And I think this brings us to an interesting point in the conversation, because you weren't just curious about, you were acting on your curiosity about the past even then.
Yes.
And I think one of the most riveting things you did, and I want you to give us a sense of this by reading a bit from the book, was as a child of 12, I think, getting curious about our own Civil War, realizing that the veterans of that war were fast disappearing. I think they're now many years all gone.
Yes.
And feeling you had to get in touch with them.
Yes. When I was about 12, which would have been in 1954, the Washington Post had an article, I think, in fact, several articles, about the fact that there were three or four incredibly ancient veterans of the Civil War still alive. I believe that at the time that I became interested in this, there was one Union veteran and there were three Confederates, which seems disproportionate since there were, in fact, so many more Union soldiers than Confederates. But it may simply be that Confederate soldiers tended to be younger, or at least the surviving ones were people who had been teenagers. So I wrote to three of these veterans, the Washington Post having thoughtfully given their address. And I actually received one letter back from a relative on behalf of one of these veterans, and I'll read the letter. On the envelope, W.A. Lundy wrote his name without glasses. No, he didn't see the people you mentioned in your letter. I think I must have mentioned Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis and Abraham Lincoln, the famous people of that era. But here is a couple of things he remembers. I lived near Elba, Alabama. Was only 16 when the war closed. One day the Yankees was on us before we realized it. But we hit the ground and their fire went above us. Then we let them have it with our guns. The groans and taken on was terrible. Then another time we was skinning a beef near a house. The Yankees came in the house. We left the beef, went in the house, and captured them. These are the things he remembers most. He said it was terrible times then. Sure hope this is all right. You see, he's not able to read or write, but signs his name a lot of times for people. He can walk some, but can't remember too well. I'm his son's wife. He lives with us now since his baby girl died. Thank you for writing him.
Thank you for putting it in the book.
Well, that simply reinforced this whole sense of the past as being gone, complete, unchangeable, and yet somehow accessible, at least in part, so that we continue to have transactions with it. And in this case, I had a sort of transaction with a man who was very nearly 100 years older than I was.
Let's probe that. It's there, it's complete, it's accessible, although difficult. But what does it do for you in trying to get back to it? In other words, what is the benefit of this this use of the past for the person trying to use memory to get to it and make sense of it? Is there some kind of affirmative value?
I'm not sure that I would describe it in terms of a use. Mm-hmm. It certainly connects one with more of the human species than is alive at any one moment. Mm-hmm. It connects one with the tragedies of the past, mm-hmm. also with the triumphs of the past, and mm-hmm. I think you can find both in the American Civil War. It connects one with the generations. Mm-hmm. It changes one's attitude towards life, or if one starts out to some extent this way, as I apparently did, it gives one a certain approach to life, which, whatever else it may be, is not chronologically shallow.
Well, because it's not chronologically shallow, and because it's so personal and individual, is it kind of stretching a bit, perhaps, but a statement of personal? Can you achieve a statement of personal growth through this, or can you become more free, perhaps, by using the past individually, constructing your own sense of what the world was and is through your own connection with the past?
I suppose you become more independent of whatever the prevailing assumptions are, as well as whatever the prevailing media of information are, mm-hmm. in the time that you are actually living.
Right.
You develop a sense of life before you were born. My students, many of them, have no sense that anything that was mm-hmm. important could possibly have happened before they were born.
Right.
Now, of course, there are others who take a much more profound view of human life than that. But one often finds this sense, particularly in a society that is so present-oriented mm-hmm. and even future-oriented as the United States today, that nothing that happened more than 10 or 20 years ago, depending really on the age of the person who is mm-hmm. Who is saying this, could possibly have been of any but the most peripheral importance.
Yes. Which leads me to your favorite chapter, your favorite essay about your two grandfathers.
Yes, my grandfathers were both in some ways extraordinary men. One of them was the child of immigrants, born in New York City in 1879, the child of immigrants from northern Germany. The other was a Jewish immigrant from Romania who came to this country in 1900 when he was 16 years old and subsequently wrote what was at the time a very famous book called An American in the Making. His name was Marcus Eli Ravage. And that book got him invited, since this is the Woodrow Wilson Center, it's worth saying this, it got him invited to the White House by Woodrow Wilson.
Oh, really?
For breakfast.
I didn't know that.
Yes. He was for a while in the teens and 20s, he was a pretty well-known writer,
yeah.
mostly on the strength of being an outstandingly successful immigrant who had achieved all of the success that usually takes two or three generations mm-hmm. within a very few years.
You know, the extraordinary thing for me reading this, and I found these both very compelling stories, and the story of Marcus Ravage in particular, a very poignant one, is the contrast between these two men. Adam Peter Clausen from Germany, I think, both had colorful lives, no question about it. Adam Peter Clausen, as I recall, went from selling newspapers to being a cavalryman at one point.
Yes,
a pharmaceutical salesman. I mean, it is kind of the American immigrant experience in microcosm.
Yes. He was born. His parents had immigrated to this country. He was born on the Lower East Side about a decade after they had come to this country. Grew up in poverty. Dropped out of school at the age of 12 to help support his family. Went to work in a drugstore. Found that when he was perhaps about 20, that he was not getting anywhere. He was still part of the German immigrant community, and he wanted a more adventurous life. He wanted to be a real American, as he saw that. He wanted to get beyond the community in which people still spoke German all those decades after they had come to this country. And of all things, he joined the United States Cavalry, mm-hmm. this boy from New York City. Well, it was a time when horses were everywhere, you know, at least he was familiar with horses. But I doubt that he had ever ridden one. at this time. And apparently he had a rough time learning to ride a horse and do the other things that a member of the 7th Cavalry, in fact, Custer's old regiment, although this was 30 years later,
right,
had to do. But it made a man of him in a way, and it took him permanently outside, even though he wasn't in the cavalry for very long, it took him permanently outside of that immigrant experience.
Mm-hmm.
And thereafter, he spent a very long life, mostly as a pharmaceutical salesman, at which he became quite successful. And he sent both his sons to college and was very thoroughly Americanized in a kind of easily recognizable traditional way,
yeah,
that many people have made fun of. You know, he belonged to civic groups. He was an elder of the Presbyterian Church. He was a Boy Scout leader. Once the United States entered World War I, he forbade his wife to speak German at home anymore. It's easy to look down on that extreme degree of intolerance for what went before. And yet there's also something to appreciate there. There's a courage, there's a determination.
Yeah.
There's a strength of character in that.
And there's that, and there's also, and because of those qualities, in both cases of these two very different men, an act of self-creation, that they were committed to progressing from the immigrant experience that they knew to becoming an American. And that,
yes,
was a very important, and probably something the rest of us take for granted, but they had to sort of create themselves in that way.
Well, it is something that we take for granted, because the sort of American culture to which they wished so much to assimilate is really gone now. In my more recent book, Faded Mosaic, I describe this as post-culturalism. I say that America today is post-cultural. Well, when these two men and others like them at the peak of immigration early in the 20th century were trying to assimilate, mm-hmm, they knew very well what they were trying to assimilate,
right,
to. There was an American culture which was dependent on the English language and the assimilation of certain national ideals and heroes.
Mm-hmm.
And they were both very capable men who were very successful at doing this, although in some ways you could say at a considerable personal cost.
Yeah, I think that is pretty riveting in the treatment of the men. But I think your other point is quite right. We mock that at our own loss and peril. I mean, the fact that they were so committed to being American in so many ways is really quite an astounding personal achievement and a national achievement.
Yes.
When you get down to it.
Yes.
Christopher Claus, in concluding our conversation, I want to focus on the concluding essays of the book, and appropriately, the final essays and chapters I thought of as a meditation on death, really, and loss, and a connection with those who go before. Because ultimately, this dialogue with the past is, by definition, a dialogue with the dead and what can be gained from it. And I was mindful of a couple of phrases from E.M. Forster's from Howard's End. The most famous one, of course, is Only Connect. And the whole book, I think, is could be subtitled Only Connect and Why. But he also, in a less popularly remembered phrase, described death as the great explainer. And I had that in mind as I read this. So maybe as we conclude, you might give us a sense of how you found this whole question of the dialogue with the dead that is a part of our use of memory, or our short-term memory.
Yes. I don't think I thought of it that way until my younger brother died in his 40s of lymphoma about 10 years ago. He was a political scientist of great gifts. He had, in fact, been a fellow of the Woodrow Wilson Center. His field was nuclear disarmament, and somehow the death of a contemporary affects one in a way that the death of an older person doesn't. So I began thinking about this relationship with the past in a more poignant way, as a relationship with one's own personal dead. And I wrote the last essay in the book, called Dialogues with the Dead, to try and figure out the way in which this conversation with the dead works, as it does, I think, in all of our lives, unless we've been so fortunate that no one that we've ever been close to has died. And I'm going to read the first couple of paragraphs of that essay, because it describes not the death of my brother, but a rather dramatic dialogue with the dead conducted by someone else in my family. My great-grandmother's 8th pregnancy was a difficult one. After all, she was nearly 48 years old when it began. Of her 5 living children, 2 others having died in infancy, the 2 oldest, my grandfather and his sister Marie, were already in their mid-teens. Contrary to what might have been expected, however, she carried the fetus to term, and in the autumn of 1896 gave birth to a healthy boy who had lived through most of the following century. Her own prognosis was not so fortunate. Never fully recovered from the birth of her final child, after 21 months she knew she was dying. Moreover, she knew only too well that her husband, not a good provider in the language of the day, would be hard-pressed to maintain an infant and 3 other small children, whatever help the oldest son, now at work but eager to enlist in the Spanish-American War, might provide. She was, like her husband, an immigrant. Her own family was far away. "Promise me," she said to her daughter Marie in German, "promise me that you will keep the family together and raise your brother Charlie." What could a late 19th century girl say to such an appeal? Besides, she adored her mother. "Mama," she answered inevitably, "I promise." In that world, that was how they did things. What's more, they sometimes meant it. My great-aunt Marie kept the family together, raised her brother Charlie, and for good measure helped raise his children and grandchildren. She had a career, never married, and lived to be 98. When Charlie died a few years before she did, she felt reasonably enough that life had become absurd and that it was high time to depart. Her final wish was to be buried in the grave of the mother to whom she had so spectacularly kept a promise made 81 years earlier, and with whom she had carried on a dialogue that furnished the pattern for an entire life. Near the end of 1979, the customs of the late 20th century yielded grudgingly to the sentiments of the 19th, and the ancient grave was reopened for its second occupant.
It's very powerful, Christopher.
Well, that I think is a model, an unusual model, but a sensational sort of model for the conversations that we have with those to whom we were close, who are no longer alive.
For that model, for that excerpt from the book, for the book itself, for the conversation, thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Christopher Clausen, professor of English literature at Pennsylvania State University and author of My Life with President Kennedy. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Dale. Our technical director is John Tyler, and our production assistant is Andrea Bertone. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
To order a Dialogue program or for more information, contact us at 202-691-4146. You can also listen to Dialogue on the web at wilsoncenter.org/dialogue. Email us on America Online at radiodial@aol.com. That's radiodial@aol.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.